Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prishkintas.
We gather here once a week at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. We talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions, and we get
Yes, we are opinionated.
We are. Oh. The following is an encore presentation of the Donalana Kitchen. Enjoy. Fall is in the air. Ah, nuts. Nuts. They fall from trees. We're going to be talking about nuts today and a seasonal treat. Donna talked with Luke Grant earlier this week, and you talked about chestnuts. Chestnuts kind of went away for a while, and they're back. So we'll find out more about that later in the show. What can you tell us about chestnuts, Donna?
Well, right off the bat, 'tis the chestnut season. And so you'll see them in stores. And for a number of years, they were often imported from Italy or somewhere in Europe for reasons that we will get into when we play the interview with Luke Grant, one of our local foresters. However, we are getting some Iowa chestnuts now. And they're I've seen them, well, I'm buying some at Farm to Folk today. So for me, a big treat is chestnuts roasted, which is very simple. How I do it, I crank the oven up to maybe 400 or something, and the chestnuts have like one flat side, basically, usually, right? Mm-hmm. So you can lay them on the chopping board, and you can either, I just whack them, kind of dent into them with one, or you can do a crisscross, which would be two whacks with the knife. And then I just put them in a dry cast iron skillet and roast them till they're done, as we say. Kind of done depends on the size of the chestnut. So while I'm saying 10 to 15 minutes, it doesn't really take very long. So I just put them in the oven and I take one out after, you know, when I feel like it's the appropriate time, and I just take one out and try it. And if it's gotten nice and soft, but not too dried out, then I know it's ready, and I take the whole pan out. And usually I just put them on something that can hold a hot pan and set them in the middle of the table, and I serve them. This is my favorite. Simple after-dinner dessert is the roasted chestnuts, fresh out of the oven. Everybody peels their own at the table. And I serve them with either Bailey's Irish Cream, or there's a one made by the Mississippi Distilling Company, which is similar and not quite as sweet, and I like it a lot, called Iowish. Or even you can make chestnuts and dairy go really, really well together. So even if you made a mixture of, oh, boy, I did it the other day with spiced rum and a little bit of cream and some apple juice or something like that, you know.
A little bit of sweet.
Yeah, a little sweet and spice. But something kind of rich and dairy goes, I mean, even a glass of milk I like with them because they're dry, but they're rich, but they're not as rich as most nuts. They're lower in fat.
Ah.
But just eating them fresh and plain is kind of the delight of the season, because there is a point sometime around slightly after Christmas where they will start to dry out, not be as good.
That's right. This is one of those very seasonal things. Chestnuts kind of come and they're perfect, kind of like strawberries. They come, they're perfect. You eat them and really enjoy them.
There are other ways to extend the season, and Luke talks about that a little bit, but also you can buy them peeled in vacuum packs, which I think are usually pretty good, especially if you're going to – you don't just want to heat them up and eat them, but they're good for cooking that way. Also, there are a lot of more European products, predominantly French and some Italian, where they're already pureed in the can.
Oh.
And they're sweetened and unsweetened, which you can use for cooking. Like, they're great in cakes, or even one time in Italy, I had a chestnut ice cream.
Oh, now that.
Yeah. So I imagine you could, you know, you would probably start with roasting your chestnuts, and then you'd probably have to puree them pretty carefully to get the lumps out. But, of course, the easy way is to buy the canned puree.
Is that canned puree stuff available here, or one can order it? I've never
seen. I've seen them. Certainly you can. I mean, go on Amazon. There were like 20 products, you know. Yeah. But pick what you want, sweetened or unsweetened. Mm-hmm. I've seen, actually, I think Wheatsfield had chestnuts in the jar.
In the jar? Oh, like chunks of chestnuts whole in the jar?
Yeah. Which I've used in, they're wonderful in turkey stuffing.
Oh, there you go.
You know, just as you might put nuts in it, but chestnuts are particularly wonderful in turkey stuffing. And there are many, many ways of using chestnuts.
Oh, and somehow that seems a winter sort of thing, the idea of some character out of a Charles Dickens story selling roasted chestnuts on the corner.
I had a dinner the weekend I was in Kelowna, and she roasted her chestnuts, and she put them in a kind of sweet and sour cabbage saute with chestnuts, and I believe she had maybe raisins or currants or something. But a good amount of chestnuts. Be generous with the chestnuts. They're really quite lovely. And they are lower in fat than most nuts. So my favorite recipe with chestnuts, which I thought I was going to bring today, and I couldn't find it because it's probably been 15 years since I cooked it. But
it's probably in your head someplace.
Oh, it's like in my treasured memories section.
Like riding a bicycle. There we go.
I used to be big on – I mean, I've switched to making fudge for Christmas presents in the last few years. But I went through a period of about 5 years where I made truffles for presents, all kinds of flavors and this and that. And then I had my clients, you know, my Hollywood personality – famous actor clients.
Yes, because in Donna's sordid past, she cooked for some pretty, some well-known people out in California. So there you go.
And of course, since they're all actors, they have to be thin. So one of the main requirements of my cooking was that it be calorically reduced, right? So I found a recipe that was a chestnut truffle recipe. So basically, chocolate truffles are, you melt the chocolate, you mix it with butter and cream, and that's the basis. You can flavor it or not flavor it or put something in the middle, and then you let it harden back up in the refrigerator and roll it into little balls and cover it in powdered chocolate. So that's the basic recipe. So this recipe, instead of using butter, used chestnuts, and I used the vacuum-packed, if I were a really, really a good person, I would use fresh chestnuts. But it was during a time when most of the chestnuts were imported. And anyway, so I used the vacuum-packed, pre-cooked chestnuts and ground them up and put them with melted chocolate, probably a bittersweet chocolate, and maybe a little bit of brandy or some, you know, one of those Armagnac or something like that, and then rolled them up and made reduced fat truffles, right? Chocolate truffles.
You talk about rolling them up. It sounds like this is mushy stuff. How does it roll?
Well, it's soft, chocolate ganache.
Oh, it's kind of like thick frosting. Sort
very,
of.
Very,
very
thick.
Oh, very
and
thick.
And you put it, you kind of refrigerate it till you want to roll it. So you know how chocolate firms up, and then if you take it out of the fudge even, okay? If I store it in the fridge, and then to serve it and cut it, I'll take it out and kind of let it warm up a little bit. So the chocolate ganache or the chocolate and chestnut ganache is the same thing because for the truffles with butter, of course, butter hardens in the refrigerator as well as chocolate hardening in the refrigerator. So the whole trick with chocolate truffles is to soften it up enough to take like a 1 inch and you kind of roll it in your hands till it's a ball because your hands will warm it a little bit and make it soft and round. And then especially if you're sticking something in the center like a nut or a piece of crystallized ginger or something like that. And then you roll it around in Dutch processed cocoa powder, and then you put it back in the refrigerator.
Ah.
Usually it's easier if you put it in one of those little candy baking cups because that holds it and makes it easier to move them around.
Oh, this also sounds like a very good opportunity for licking fingers and sort of like tasting this as it goes along.
But of course.
Oh, very good.
Of course. So I try not to make them late at night because I'm sensitive enough to chocolate. It'll keep me up all night.
Oh.
I know.
A thing to remember.
Yes, to do in the middle of the day. So here's my promise that on one of our Christmas shows, I will reconstruct the chestnut chocolate truffle recipe. Of course, this is 15 years ago. Who knows what's happened to my memory?
Chocolate truffles with chestnuts.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Chestnut flour is another thing that's widely used in, Italian cooking. You can put them in, substitute some of the flour. I would say not to probably go more than 25%, but like take your favorite chocolate chip recipe.
Oh, in a sweet, yes.
Yeah,
oh.
In a cookie or in a cake and put some chestnut flour in. It makes it just one more level of flavor. It's subtle, but it's really good.
Oh, that sounds like
you don't taste them go, oh, is this chestnut? You go, oh, this is really rich.
Really
nutty
rich.
Nutty flavored.
Really?
You know.
Chestnut flour.
Yeah.
Nut flours.
Yeah, so I suppose one would have to buy that online, too. I don't think I've seen any locally.
And it's things like chestnut flours and chestnuts, like we mentioned before, are very seasonal, and they probably don't. Keeping things in the refrigerator and using them up well so the flour doesn't go bad.
Oh, yeah. I think keeping the flour maybe even in the freezer. Of course,
okay.
Really good flours, we recommend doing that anyway. Mm-hmm. And I definitely store my chestnuts in the refrigerator once I'm picking some up at Farm to Folk today. Are you getting some, Lana?
Yes, I am.
Oh, boy.
Yes, they are available. And those are local. And speaking of recipes, you can find the recipes that we talk about here on the show on the Donna Lana Kitchen recipe page. You can go to khoifm.org and you'll find the radio page there. And you'll also find out lots more about the radio and the fact that this is community radio. And also, I'll take a little time to mention here that this radio station is going to be holding a fundraiser next week, I think beginning this Friday and going through to the next Friday. And we'll have kind of a special fun and silly, and it'll be a fun and silly whole week from a lot of people. A lot of the DJs and hosts will do special things all week, and Donna and I will come up with some sort of
to get your attention to help you remember to send a check to your lovely local radio station.
Yes, and when you do that, mention the Donna Lana Kitchen. We can use your support. We spend a lot of time talking here, and we're just hoping that people out there listen.
We want to know if anybody's paying any attention at all.
That's right.
I mean, Lana and I have a really good time regardless, but, it would be nice to know that it's of interest to some other people, too.
Yes, and also you can contact us by going to the Gmail, khoiradio@gmail.com, and let us know what you think. What's on your plate? Do you have chestnut experience? Do you have a favorite holiday recipe? Let us know. You can do that, too. You are listening to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa.
Today we are going to interview Luke Gran, and Luke is a forester. Now, Luke, When I think of forester, I think of cutting down trees, but I'm sure it's more complicated than that. So Luke is an Iowa boy, born here, raised here, schooled here, and he has started a new company called Prudentera. Luke, tell us what Prudentera is and what a forester does.
Thank you, Donna. Well, foresters, you're not totally wrong. Foresters cut down trees, for sure.
But more than that. It's not like being a woodsman, you know, stocking the woodpile. It's much more complicated, right?
Yeah, it's a science. Forestry is a science. And is
that like deciding which trees to cut down?
Yeah.
Okay.
For strategic management of wood products,
mm-hmm.
Woodlands for wildlife habitat, for water conservation, for timber production, wood fiber production. Really, in America, the forestry science didn't start until about the early 1900s.
Doesn't ISU have a forestry department?
Yeah, that's a department. It's in the discipline of agriculture. So
did you study there?
I studied at Iowa State. That's right.
Uh-huh.
It's one of the top five forestry schools in the country.
Really? Excellent. Well, how come we have no forests around here?
Well, what's funny is we do have about 6 million acres of forests in Iowa. So people don't think about it, but right along all the rivers,
okay.
In northeast Iowa and southeast Iowa.
Well, thank heavens
and
for
we
the
grow,
forest.
Yeah, we grow incredibly valuable black walnut timber. It's the most valuable timber in the whole country, actually.
Really?
It's black walnut. It's very
And so are the black walnuts. We love black walnuts.
We love black walnuts. The nuts are great. The timber is excellent. But in addition to managing timber, foresters can help people manage snow loading, drifts of snow, by intentionally planting trees and windbreaks and shelter belts to improve their farms.
Well, that's much more attractive than snow fences.
That's right. Yeah, it's a living snow fence. It's something that can and not just hold the snow back. It can also increase your crop yields. Field windbreaks can increase your corn yield by about 12%.
Really? Because?
Right. The trees help to reduce evapotranspiration, which is the
evapotranspiration.
Loss.
I think I get that.
So when a plant is photosynthesizing, that means it's taking sunlight, solar energy, and converting it to sugar.
Mm-hmm.
If it's stressed by wind, it will spend more energy taking care of itself and less energy.
Oh, because they'll have more evaporation.
That's right. So it'll increase the evapotranspirative loss, and it'll require the plant to work harder to make up for it.
Well, if we could get 12% more yields, why are we not full of windbreaks around here?
I would love to plant more windbreaks for every farmer I meet. It's a really hard sell. People perceive trees on cropland as a waste of money. It's quite the opposite. If you intentionally plant trees, the right kind of species and the right soil types, you can achieve that kind of beneficial value of trees. But what often happens is farmers have more experience with mulberry trees and other species that are not desirable for this value. There's, unfortunately, in a farm environment, there are some trees that make corn and soybean production a challenge.
Well, even in my backyard, I'm cutting them down. But
species is quite a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
We've got quite a bit of buckthorn and honeysuckle shrubs in our woodlands. And so foresters can help people manage, whether you're a homeowner, or an acreage owner, or farmer, you've definitely got a value in considering bringing on an expert like a forester to help look at your cropland and find the low profitability parts of your farm and try to get those converted back to some of our native ecosystems to improve our water quality and our habitat for pollinators and other important species in our lives.
So what about the nut-bearing species? Specifically, we're going to talk about chestnuts today, of course, but what other nut-bearing species can we plant around here? Because that is an income crop.
That's right. Nuts are very very interesting potential crop for people to think about. One of the most exciting possibilities out there is the Chinese chestnut. It's a crop you can plant once and then harvest for hundreds or even over 1,000 years.
Okay, now here's the nitty gritty story. When I think of chestnuts, okay, let's go back to Nat King Cole singing "Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire." Or then there's the poem that all children had to learn in grade school, "Under the Blooming Chestnut Tree, the Village Smithy Stands." You know, I mean, so this is an American iconic nut, and also eaten a lot in Europe. tell us why we now have the Chinese chestnut.
Okay.
What's Chinese about it?
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, trees in America, and nut trees especially in America, were a big part of the reason why America was such a profitable place to have a colony and to settle. It was thought that for the first 100 years of agriculture in the new world, people had hogs that were fattened every year on
acorns, of course,
and
chestnuts.
Chestnuts.
So this is all basically early East Coast colonial farming.
Yeah. So throughout the eastern deciduous forest, which goes from Iowa all the way east to New England, and it's still there along the river valleys and all the way across the country. The most important species in that ecosystem was the American chestnut. It was the largest tree, the tallest tree, the largest diameter.
Yeah.
It produced an incredible amount of mast. Mast is a forester's term for nut production. So the seeds produced by trees is mast.
Mast. We like that word.
So the American chestnut was a huge part of why our ancestors were so successful in establishing.
Because the pigs here would actually just go out in the forest and feed themselves.
Absolutely. They'd gorge themselves on chestnuts in the fall. And they'd,
and acorns.
Yep.
Wow.
Until about 1915 or so, there was an oriental, get this, there was an Asian pest, a disease, that came from, they called it oriental at the time, but it was a Chinese pest, a blight came mm-hmm. through, kind of like our emerald ash borer.
Yes.
And it annihilated, within 30 years, it annihilated every single American chestnut. The whole forest was just wiped out from this chestnut
blight. And
what
year was that?
1910 to 1940. Really recently, really. I mean, our grandparents.
Well, even I can remember, when my daughter was young, so that's 40 years ago, I lived in a rural area and we had a gorgeous chestnut tree. So let's see, that would have been 1970s.
Very possible. There was probably some new chestnuts planted, potentially even some Chinese chestnuts. So the whole reason why we went with Chinese chestnuts is because they were naturally resistant to this blight.
So now I noticed in the last 10 years, more and more we're starting to see domestic chestnuts again, especially even here in Iowa, local chestnuts. I know I've seen them at Farm to Folk. Mm-hmm. Somebody's delivering them. I've seen them in the ones in Weedsfield, even though they're small, are Iowa chestnuts. So when would these trees have been planted?
You know, it takes about 7 to 10 years to get some commercial production. So I would say that if these folks started in the mid-90s or late-90s, that'd mm-hmm. be early enough, recent enough to have a crop.
And how tall is a chestnut tree after 7 years?
Well, the height of a tree is really dependent on the quality of the site and how densely.
How much sun it gets, you mean?
The quality of the site is kind of talking about the kind of soils, like how high quality, how fertile the soils are, and how well-suited are they to grow the trees.
And what are chestnuts like in soil?
Chestnuts like well-drained soils that are slightly acidic. If you've got a well-drained soil, you know, something doesn't get too waterlogged in the spring or at all, chestnuts will be happy. And if it's not low enough pH, 5.5 to 6.5 is their favorite range.
And what makes soils like that around here have that?
Clarion. PH? Clarion would be a typical.
Okay, clarion is.
Well, if I was talking to farmers, they'd probably know some of these names. But
I know, but this is, we're at the kitchen table here. So you're here to educate me and all of those who are listening with us. So
yeah.
What's clarion?
Yeah, so soil types that are well-drained are loamy, which a loam soil means it's got equal parts sand, silt, and clay.
So it's kind of loose then.
Yeah, it's a loose soil.
Uh-huh.
It feels like if you picked it up in your hand, it would feel nice and soft and not too heavy and thick, you know, mm-hmm. it'd be fairly, and it's the acidity you can only tell by using a pH test.
What makes, other than pine needles make soil acidic, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So chestnuts would do well interspersed with pine?
Probably not. Yeah, it's
too acidic?
Yeah, I mean, if your goal is like a high value chestnut orchard, you'd want to select the best.
So you actually have to pick the spot. So what kind of spot, if they like drained soil, maybe on a sloping piece, what else?
They'd like to have Not in the valleys, you know, because you can get frost pockets. That's dangerous. Mm-hmm. So like just with any orchard, you don't want to put them in the low spots because they'll get zapped by a spring frost, you know, when they've started to flower.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, so a chestnut is like an apple tree. If the flowers get zapped, you don't have nuts?
It's not as sensitive as apple trees are. Apple trees and chestnut trees are miles apart in their complexity and challenge to grow in Iowa.
Well, when do they bloom? I know in France they have a lot of chestnut trees, and it seems to me they were blooming in Brittany in June, maybe? I don't know. They were gorgeous.
My favorite reference for Chinese chestnuts in Iowa is the Chestnut Growers Primer, written and illustrated by Tom Wall.
Okay.
So Tom Wall's a wonderful farmer from southeast Iowa and Lawaiga.
So Tom is growing a lot of chestnuts then, I guess, huh?
I think he's got 5 or so acres planted now of Chinese chestnuts. Yeah.
Now, how would one market 5 acres of chestnuts?
The market is tremendous for chestnuts. If you've got the supply, there's people all over the country that will send a truck, a semi-truck, to take all the chestnuts.
So 5 acres would fill a semi-truck then?
Oh, not necessarily. I think it really depends on the – just like with every crop, it depends on the year, you know, how much the yield is. And
well, what about a year like this where we've had a lot of rain,
excellent.
Not too hot, not too cold?
Chinese chestnuts definitely need rain in August. That's when they're filling their nuts.
We did it.
So that was excellent. So I'm sure it's been a bumper crop year for
Chinese chestnuts. Oh, good. So we can say this year is a good chestnut year.
That's right.
Okay, now what determines the size of the chestnut?
The variety of the genetics plays a huge role.
Oh, there's different kinds of Chinese chestnut trees.
Yeah, just like cultivars or varieties are different for different.
So why would you plant the one with small nuts? Everybody wants the big nuts.
Actually, there are markets where it's actually a very diverse marketplace. So you've got some buyers that only want medium-sized nuts, and you've got some buyers that only want extra-large nut-sized nuts.
Well, what are people doing with them besides the culinary things? Obviously, you can make flour out of it, which is wonderful for baking. You can certainly – recipes, they're just great for roasting and eating. So what else are they used for? Pig food? That would seem very luxurious.
Yeah, if you've got a low-quality chestnut, like something that's been – if you've got, like, for example, stuff that's got weevils in it or something, ideal for feed for livestock.
Now, so the pigs eat the shell and everything?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They'll just gobble it up.
Okay.
So excited about it.
And they do the same thing with acorns? They eat the whole shell and everything?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. And that's how you get the best pork. So good for those little guys. So how are we doing in Iowa in terms of planting chestnuts?
It's a fine place for growing Chinese chestnuts. Yeah, if you're in the southeast half of the state, definitely. You've got ideal soil types and climate to grow several different varieties.
Oh, so is it difficult the colder you get?
Yeah, if you get up to northwest Iowa, it's not advised at this time to plant Chinese chestnuts. You'd have to plant American chestnut hybrids. Because American chestnuts can grow way up in Canada.
Oh, okay.
But Chinese chestnuts are
more... we now have new American chestnut hybrids that can withstand the pest from China.
They think there's hybrids that they've been hybridizing Chinese chestnuts with American chestnuts. There's some promising hybrids that have tried to breed into the American chestnut, the Chinese chestnut resistance.
Well, great. Mm-hmm. So what kind of market? For example, Tom Wall, who's growing... Are his 5 acres of chestnuts?
They are, yeah.
And what do you suppose he does with them?
Well, I was just down there last fall. I visited Tom at his place maybe 5 or 6 times over the last 5 years, and we're good friends.
5 acres must be beautiful, huh?
It's gorgeous. It's really fun to walk onto a farm that's got a bunch of trees in a
now,
row.
Are they planted in rows like orchards?
Yeah.
Huh.
Very similar, just to facilitate mowing, to facilitate management.
Oh, okay.
Mowing is really important for Chinese chestnut production because all the nuts fall off onto the ground.
Oh, so you want to be able to find them.
You've got to pick them up off the ground.
How do you harvest them? By hand?
Yeah, you use this little thing called a nut wizard. It's a little basket with a stick, and so you like roll this basket on the ground.
Oh, I've seen those. It's a sort of a large wire egg shape.
Yep.
But now chestnuts have, don't they have that prickly kind of furry cover?
Yeah, no, that's only on the tree.
So the nut doesn't fall until it opens out of the burry thing, and then you just roll the little nut grabber over it?
Yep.
And...
so the burrs protect the nuts while they're ripening on the tree,
uh-huh.
And then the burrs open up and the nuts fall to the ground.
How Does, like, the tree disgorge everything at once, or you have to keep running the little nut grubber around for a period of a few weeks, or how do you harvest
every day? You got to pick them up off the ground for a harvest season that could last between 2 and 8 weeks long.
So if you have 5 acres, is there a mechanical nut picker-upper?
There are several designs that have been tried, like in California, where they have, like, bare dirt understories where they don't have any vegetation at all.
That would not be good.
Yeah.
Too much soil erosion.
Too much soil erosion risk. Yeah. And so really the best way, most efficient way to pick up the nuts is by hand. And Tom Wall actually has a list of like 80 people who will drive 3 hours one way for the privilege to pay him to pick up Chinese chestnuts.
You mean it's a pick your own?
You pick. All of his nuts last year were picked up.
You're
by
kidding. UBIC. That's how he sells everything?
Immigrants from Bosnia actually come from Waterloo every year.
Oh, you're kidding.
They just love it. It's Eastern Bosnia, I think, has just a really strong cultural tradition of Chinese chestnuts.
Oh, goody. Then do you have any idea what kind of recipes they're making with those chestnuts?
Almost all of them are just eating them fresh. They go to a park and they make a big fire and they roast nuts and talk and gab and have a great time and eat roasted chestnuts fresh.
I could understand that. I love to eat them roasted fresh. Now, do you know anything about nutritionally what chestnuts do?
Oh, they're phenomenal. They're a starchy nut. They're kind of like the corn of nuts. So they literally have been referred to as the corn of nuts. So they're very high in starch. They are very low in fat.
Yes, I was going to say they're much lower in fat than most nuts, but they're still a nut. So how's the protein in them?
Pretty good. Pretty good source of protein, low amount of fat, but not a super protein rich nut like others. So it's really you got to think of it as like a, you know, it's commonly used as stuffing in poultry. So it's got a starchy component that you should really It's a kind of like a fun like popcorn's starch and so.
Do you encourage people who are like, for example, if somebody has like a part of a farm that was, we used to call it the woodlot, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, obviously, you have to manage it in some ways. Could one put chestnuts in something like that?
Chestnuts, you know, you're going to probably want to put a chestnut in, you know, wherever you have the best, highest quality soil, the well-drained and slightly acidic soil. In a woodlot, you know, you're going to probably need at least 100 feet by 100 feet of open space so you can get enough sunlight to...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because it's not a shade-tolerant tree.
And is the same thing true if you want to put acorns in? Apparently, we're losing our oaks, too, because we have so much scrub that the little guys are not getting the sun they need.
Yeah, oaks are a shade-intolerant species, so they only regenerate when they have full sun. So oaks evolved to regenerate in the open sun after a prairie fire, and they creeped into the prairie from the woodland edge, and that's why we have so many oaks in Iowa, because we have a really long history of fire in our ecosystems.
But, yes, which we don't do much anymore.
Yeah, we need to do more fire on the landscape. We need to have more fire on the landscape for sure. So. Yeah, so if I was going to plant a Chinese chestnut on a farm, I would I'd find the best soil types to suit that species and give it a lot of full sun for rigorous growth. Although here I just said that on my own little farmstead, we have a little windbreak on the north side of the house.
Outside of in rural Nevada.
Yeah, we rent a little farm from my family, and we just put in a row of Chinese chestnuts and pawpaws.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, that's right.
And pawpaws. You can do them together?
That's right. So pawpaw is an understory tree.
Oh.
So it'll tolerate shade of the chestnut. And so we did 20 by 20 spacing for the Chinese chestnuts.
Okay. So you put a chestnut tree and then you space 20 feet.
To the 20 feet apart from other trees, 20 feet apart from the next chestnut.
Okay.
And then we stuck in a pawpaw 10 feet between the two.
And how big does a pawpaw get?
Oh, they'll get to be about 20, 25 feet probably max. So fairly small understory tree.
Okay. How long now? How big were the chestnuts when you planted them? Did you start with
I started with seed. So I started with seed from Tom Wall, and then I put it in grew it out in a tree pot.
Mm-hmm.
Typical like a seedling tree growing, tree production pot, like a container pot. And then I waited until the tree was about 3 feet tall and stuck it in.
How long did it take to get to be 3 feet tall?
Well, I think I started growing it in the spring, and by August it was 2 or 3 feet tall.
Oh, it grew that much in 1 year?
Yep.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's really fun to grow your own trees.
3 feet. Okay, so you put a 3-foot chestnut seedling out, mm-hmm. and then how big was the pawpaw?
Pawpaw was about half that size. They are really slow growing.
Oh, good. So the chestnut will just keep shooting up above the pawpaw.
Yep.
Now, where would you stick the persimmon trees in that mix?
Ooh, I love persimmons. I stuck them in a more open spot to the probably separate from the chestnut grove.
Did you actually put some in?
I put 2 persimmons in last fall.
So, oh, yeah. I started one years ago, and now it's about, maybe it's 12 or 14 feet
nice.
Tall. Yeah, except that I realized I only have one.
Oh.
I know, that's not doesn't
need,
work. Yeah, yeah. We got to get in. Well, when I started, I stuck 3 around, but only one grew to adulthood, so I got to get on it. So, harvesting chestnuts, then they just like fall from the sky and you pick them up and they're ready for roasting, right? As soon as they fall out of the tree.
Well, you want to cure them first.
Oh, curing. You have to cure them.
Yeah, curing is the best.
How do you cure them?
Curing is very simple. It's just you have to just wait a few certain number of days.
What, are they just too wet when they first fall?
Yeah, they're just like every nut, they improve their flavor after you cure them. So just every species has different curing.
Well, is curing basically drying?
Yeah, at a certain humidity and temperature range that they prefer.
So, for example, if you went down to Tom Walls and you picked 2 bushels of chestnuts up off the ground, then what would you do?
So you got to
spread them out on the dining room table.
Well, make sure that they're separated from any leaves, twigs, or burrs, or mm-hmm. rocks, or anything. Make sure there's no dirt on them. Clean them off mm-hmm. if you got a little dirt on them. And then they should be sealed in a Ziploc bag, and just somewhere they can get a high humidity.
High humidity.
Yeah.
So you're not drying them.
Yep. And then keep them cool.
And, like how cool?
Probably between 28 and 30 degrees Fahrenheit. That's for storage temperature. So fairly cool.
So below freezing.
Yeah, just that's how they can maintain the longest shelf life. You keep them really cold.
So you would put them in the freezer? Or that's too cold?
That's too cold, yeah. It's high humidity, but very cool. Hmm. So 80 to 90% humidity is the preferred.
My best advice is eat them before they rot. I mean, usually I do eat them in the fall. That's the normal, up to winter. And they will start to rot if you're not careful.
Yeah, it's really important that they stay.
And they also can get so dry that even when you roast them, they're just completely crunchy. I mean, inedible for that method.
Yeah, but you can always grind them up and use them as flour if they get too dry.
Yeah, but you still have to get that outer shell off of them.
You know the secret to that? Is just make a little X, like take a sharp chef's knife, make a little X in it, and stick it in the microwave for like 6
microwave.
Seconds. Microwave? I don't know.
You can stick them in the oven too, folks.
Yeah, that's true.
That's because I don't have a microwave. But
you asked me earlier about the semi-load.
Yeah.
22,000 pounds is the minimum amount that they could – if you grew enough chestnuts to have a semi-load come, take them all in one load, you'd need 22,000 pounds of chestnuts.
Sort of how many trees would that take?
Boy, if you get a yield of 4,000 or 5,000 pounds an acre, you're looking at probably 5 times 5 is 25. Yeah, you're looking at probably 4 or 5 acres of chestnuts if you get mm-hmm, a really mm-hmm. decent yield.
And how many chestnuts, if you're sticking them in a little row, can you basically put on an acre?
108 trees per acre. It's 20 by 20 spacing. And then as they grow, you'll thin down to 40 by 40.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, you start them dense, and then you thin them out. So 40 by 40-foot spacing, and then 30 years later, you probably have to thin them one more time.
And the trees will live how long?
There are Chinese chestnuts in China that are at least 1,300 years old. And there's some that have been said to be older than the birth of Christ.
So. Wow. So they last even longer than oaks?
Yeah, they could if they're managed and it's in a managed for production and maintained.
talk about an investment for future. The seven generations would be really happy if you planted them now.
That's right.
So Luke has a little sticker from his business called Prudent Terra. It says, "My farm invests in ecosystems." You want to explain that little sticker?
Well, I just feel like farmers and landowners who take care of their land with prairie, and maybe they manage their woodlands, and maybe they plant some trees or plant a Chinese chestnut orchard. They have to make an investment to make those things successful. Prairie takes about 3 years to get started, and trees can take 5 years to get started, and Chinese chestnut grove might take 7 or 10 years until you can start commercially harvesting from it.
Oh, they must be beautiful.
They are gorgeous. Yeah, and so I feel like a big part of my job is just to show people all the fun ways that, I mean, on farms, people are spending money all the time. You know, they're investing in...
It's a business.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Investing in this year for this year's crop, you know, with this spray or this chemical or... So essentially, all my recommendations or all my opportunities that I share with my clients are investments that take years to be developed.
Well, you know, I, the last farmer in my family in Illinois, my cousins, planted 25 acres of black walnut, about. And Ivan just said, this is for my grandchildren.
I was in a family meeting with a client, and I pitched several different proposals to them, you know. Blew me away, though. The oldest guy in the room was the most excited about the 15-year return on the Chinese chestnuts.
Yeah, because he knows how quickly 15 years goes, you know.
He was 80-something years old, and he was excited about getting cheap trees in the ground. There's something about legacy that's really important. And
do you happen to know what a buckeye is compared to a chestnut?
Yeah. They see here, so.
And they're beautiful, and they look like chestnuts, only they're not.
Yeah. They look actually botanically. They look nothing like chestnuts. So Ohio buckeye has a palmate shaped leaf. So it has this kind of.
Oh, you mean the tree? But the nut.
The nut.
The nut part is it? It's kind of a fooler. Can pigs eat buckeyes?
I don't know.
Do they have any value at all?
I'm sure they have some value for certain wildlife species.
Yeah, well, it's making a lovely tree, but boy, now I wish I'd put a chestnut in instead. Silly me.
I've been thinking about where Chinese chestnuts might fit in my homeowner client's yard.
Oh, I could see having a whole lawn full of chestnuts, you know. Why not just build a house in the middle of the chestnut orchard?
Those burrs are spiky. That's one downside.
Because the burrs eventually fall off?
Yep,
yes, I suppose they do,
off,
with the leaves and stuff.
Yep, so
it's deciduous.
It's good to have Chinese chestnuts just outside of the lawn, you know, just you have a nice little place for the grandkids to play, but then just outside that area, it'd be good to have some Chinese chestnuts.
Can you mulch them or something?
Yeah, you can mulch them, but these trees grow 40, 50 feet wide at some point. And so, you know, there are several Chinese chestnut trees in Ames, and I could tell you where to find them.
Around town?
Oh, yeah, right. Somebody that had an idea 20 years ago to put in some Chinese chestnuts.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, it's like, I think, between the sidewalk and the road.
Oh, okay. I bet they don't have any pigs up there either. I suppose the deer come. There are a lot of deer up over there.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Is anything else about chestnuts we need to know, Luke?
Yeah, I wanted to share a story about. There's this great book that came out. The author is Cokie Roberts, and it's called the.
You mean isn't she a television?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's she was on NPR for many years. I think she still is. But she wrote a book about the women founding fathers. You know, like the founding women of America.
Oh, I better
it's
get
phenomenal.
That book.
It's phenomenal. My only living grandmother is my wife's grandmother.
But,
her name's Virginia.
Oh, Virginia.
Yeah,
okay.
So we went down to see Virginia, and she was talking about this great book she was reading. And there was this woman named Eliza Lucas from North Carolina. And at the age of 16, she was in charge of 3 plantations.
Whoa.
And she was an incredibly diverse farmer. Manager of these plantations, and she had all these crazy ideas, you know, and I'm sure it was the talk of the town that she did all these things.
Because at 16, it was probably all the talk of the town.
Yeah, exactly. But yes, so she had several innovative ideas, and one of them was oak plantation. So she was planting oak trees when everybody else was planting cotton. It was just a great example of how in America we have this long history of innovation, and we have a long history of tree crops as a farm enhancement.
You are listening to KHOI, This is the Donalana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. This is KHOI 89.1 FM Community Radio. You heard a little bit of an interview there. Donna was talking to Luke Gran about chestnuts and other things that grow and fall from trees. So thank you, Luke Gran, for being part of our Donalana Kitchen show. He mentioned a couple of really good books, and I've got a book here, too, that I've been enjoying. Again, I get the nicest books from the Ames Public Library. This book is called Farming the Woods.
Yes.
Farming the Woods, an integrated permaculture approach to growing food and medicinals in the temperate forests by Ken Mudge and Steve Gabriel. It's one of, I get books, of course, that have really nice pictures in them, even if you don't read the thing cover to cover. Just flip through.
It's good reference work.
Yes, all kinds of things. And in there is some really good work on chestnuts. As Luke mentioned, chestnuts are coming back, different cultivars and coming back from the chestnut blight, new kinds of chestnuts coming from Asia, the new kind of varieties, and even the American chestnuts are being hybridized and made more hardy. In particular, there are a lot of case studies in here, and there are some here in the Midwest. Even if you don't have a whole forest, think of your yard in town. There's trees there. There's lots of things that can be grown for shade, for beauty, and for food. We're thinking about chocolate and chocolate and Donna, tell us about chocolate.
Well, we're thinking now we are about to eat a chocolate souffle.
Oh.
Of course, it's not souffled at the moment. It's a fallen chocolate souffle. So it's more like it came out kind of like a flourless chocolate cake, which, although there's a little flour in it, I like it.
Well, what's the difference between a flourless chocolate cake and a souffle? Kind of the same idea, right?
This actually has 2 tablespoons of flour in it.
Okay.
I like this recipe a lot. I used to make it when I had all my Hollywood clients who, of course, want, you know, the full eating experience with no calories. So this wonderful cookbook writer, Alice Medridge, she is a great dessert cookbook writer, actually. So she wrote this one. So she took all of her traditional recipes and reduced the calories significantly. I'm licking my fingers with it. So this recipe is over a double boiler, you mix 5 teaspoons of – oh, well, first you have to get the little cups out and you spray them. You know, like ramekins, basically. You spray them.
Ramekins. They're little teeny tiny
like
little
like custard
bowls.
Cup kind of things, because these are individual portions. And you spray them. I frankly just used an olive oil spray because you don't taste it very much. And then I put a very fine sugar around the inside to coat them. So you just set that up and then you put them all in a baking tray.
Oh, that's a good idea. Put not only oil or grease the inside of the pan, but sugar
a little bit. Right.
Oh, good idea. Oh, and that also makes kind of a nice little sparkly edge to it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's good.
Oh, it's so good. I'm shocked. I've been made these for about 5 years and maybe more.
Well, it's a good thing we got out the old recipe book again, huh?
Well, I was wondering if she gives calories in here. Yes, calories per serving, 127. Fat, 2.6 grams. Protein, 4.3 grams. Not bad. So anyway, you over the double boiler, then you mix the cup of powdered sugar, a half a cup of unsweetened Dutch processed cocoa. Now, I have to say, I used a really good one, a fair traded organic one, and I put a little more than they said in there because I wanted it to be really chocolatey. So if they called for half a cup, I probably put maybe an extra tablespoon or something. And then you put in 2 tablespoons of flour, and then you put half a cup of low-fat milk and half a cup of water. And then you kind of whisk that till it thickens. It takes about 10 minutes while you're doing other things over the double boiler. Now, I, of course, don't even own a double boiler. I just take a pan, you know, like a small stock pot, and put my stainless steel bowl over it, you know, mm-hmm. with the water not touching the bottom of the bowl. Okay, that's always what you have to do. Then you mix with your beater. Oh, I also put in something else you shouldn't put in. I put a little bit of that canela cinnamon, not the regular cinnamon, but the soft stick cinnamon. Gives it a kind of a fruitier depth of flavor. I can't leave anything without adding more flavor. So I did put that into the chocolate and some vanilla powder, I believe. You could also use vanilla extract. Then in a separate bowl, you whip 4 egg whites with a little bit of cream of tartar and 3 tablespoons plus 1 teaspoon, it's a little picky, of sugar. So you just beat those all up until they're really nice and fluffy. And then then when the chocolate mixture in the double boiler is thickened, you know, you've got a whisk in there and you're whisking it around and it gets quite thick. Then you take it off the heat and you mix in 2 of the egg yolks.
Wait. Okay. The egg yolks are separate. They have
right. You've separated them because you've whipped the 4 whites. Oh. That leaves 2 extra egg yolks, which I just ate.
Okay. Here we have a question. Because you have this hot chocolate mixture, do you have to let it cool down a little bit? Because if you add the egg yolks right away, don't they like cook or get stringy?
You have to whisk while you're doing it.
Okay.
And yes, you've taken it off the
okay.
So off the heat. So you're not doing it over the double boiler anymore.
Okay, this is off. And so the quickly put in 2 of the egg yolks. Mm-hmm. Got it?
So then you fold in the whites into the chocolate mixture. And I don't think you do anything else. No, then you just put them into the souffle cups and you stick them in the oven at 350 for about 15 minutes.
Oh, yes. Fold in the whites. I have... From a recipe that I remember a long time, I think it was for a flourless chocolate cake.
Very similar.
It had a great line. It said, again, do things separately. The whites are over here and the chocolate's over here and everything goes together. And in bold type, it said, if you have a large spatula, use it now.
Yes.
And folding in egg whites you have to do it dramatically. And you have to do it, you're lifting and... Mm-hmm. You don't want to squish the air out of the egg whites.
No, you're folding them.
Lift and lift.
In circular motions. Oh,
it's one of those techniques that you learn, and it's fun to do. It's fun.
It's actually quite simple. Easy to turn in.
There.
What do you think of the texture?
It's wonderful. It's looser than a cake.
Mm-hmm.
Something to eat with a spoon. It's very pretty.
If you want to gild the lily, obviously you could put whipped cream on it. Or a flavored whipped cream, like a rum-flavored whipped cream, or a bourbon-flavored whipped cream.
Or ice cream, or pudding, sweet. And it is called what?
It's called a chocolate souffle. But, we're not eating it right out of the oven, because, of course, it falls. Soufflés always fall. But when you're doing it on purpose, you don't mind. Now, if you really want to serve it as a souffle... Since it only takes 15 minutes to cook, you can prepare the batter in advance and chill it. And then when it's time for the, and if you have your souffle cups ready, you take it out of the fridge, you put it into the cups, you put it in the oven, and you cook it maybe 3 minutes longer than if it were at room temperature.
Because you're dealing with the cold
batter.
And
then you serve it right out of the oven.
Give us the name of the cookbook and the name of the author again.
It's Alice Medrich, M-E-D-R-I-C-H, and it's called Chocolate and the Art of Low-Fat Desserts. And there are a lot of other things. It's a very good book. I think it won a James Beard Award. It's well worth having the cookbook.
You've been listening to the Donna Lena Kitchen. Support this fine radio station, KHOI Community Radio.
You can listen to the Donna Lena Kitchen on a podcast. Anywhere you listen to podcasts, just poke in Donna Lena, which is one word, and kitchen is the second word, and you will hear us in that format.
If you just can't get enough of us, there we are. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Friskintas.
We had fine engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.